Hello.
I bring to you today the recording of the live show that I was very fortunate to present at the Titanic Museum attraction in Pigeon Forge just a couple of weeks ago as part of their weekend-long commemoration of the 112-year mark since Titanic sinking. I had originally planned to also put out a small episode like I normally do most seasons, kind of commemorating April 14th, 1912 to April 14th, 2022, 2023. This would have been 2024. It didn't feel right. I don't know why. Maybe I was just tired from live show prep and travel and that sort of thing. But no, I don't think that was it. I think it just didn't feel right. And then a couple of days ago, I was thinking about the book, The Watch That Ends the Night, which is the book of poetry by Alan Wolfe, written about Titanic. And if you've never picked up a copy, I highly recommend it. I really should do a whole episode about the book, maybe try to have him on the show. In it, he writes the, you know, based on reality, but slightly fictionalized perspective versions of so many people that were on the ship, from crew to passengers. It's first person poetry narrative of what they were going through that night. Even the iceberg has a voice in some of the poems. And one of the people that he spotlights in that book is Jon Snow, the undertaker on the Mackay Bennett. One of the most moving experiences I've ever had was researching the Mackay Bennett episode. The Mackay Bennett was the rescue ship out of Halifax, Nova Scotia, that went searching for Titanic's bodies, left on April 17th from Halifax, and returned on April 30th. And so I record this on April 26th, 112 years ago. Mackay Bennett would have still been out looking for bodies. I realized that maybe that's why I didn't feel like I wanted to do the April 14th or April 15th episode, because I think I had more to say about 112 years since the April 20s, when the Mackay Bennett would have been out looking for the bodies. I have not been shy in the past couple of months about how I feel a bit disconcerted, a bit somber about the state of the Titanic community. A lot of the Titanic news we've seen over the last couple of months has been very sensationalist. Things like Titanic 2 and Clive Palmer is his name in Australia. Things like that. Also Titanic kind of quote unquote influencer culture. I'm seeing this uptick in not necessarily looking to expertise or experts with the Titanic story, but looking to TikTok, looking to influencers, kind of buzzwordy Titanic world. And I know that that's not you guys. And I know that that's something that can be drowned out. And yes, the real work is going on, and I have to focus on the positive. But I have been feeling a little somber, and I think that's human, and I embrace it. And when I think about the process of the finding of Titanic wreckage and bodies, I am reminded, and I think we all are reminded, that Titanic is a story of death and suffering. And it is easy to forget that when we watch the 1997 movie, although towards the end, it's right there in your face. But I mean, when we think about Jack and Rose and we romanticize the story, or when we sit down to a recreation dinner, or we have our recreation cocktail or mocktail, or it's easy to forget that in those cold morning hours, the Mackay Bennett's crew went out in the frigid waters and recovered pieces of people's lives, bodies, objects that meant so much to them in their pockets or hanging off of them. The Wallace Hartley violin case is up for auction. He was found with it floating. There's a lot of weight to that, and always should be. We will share Instagram stories back and forth about a violin case being up for auction. And I suppose in this world, something is worth whatever someone is willing to pay for it. So who am I to judge? But these pieces of people should not be taken lightly. And so this year, 112 years later, I am thinking about the bodies. I am thinking about loss. I am thinking about all of the ways in which we owe the Titanic story reverence and respect. And the live show that I put together at Pigeon Forge represents that. My guest, Stephen Schwenkert, his work represents that in every way possible. There are so many untold stories on Titanic still to bring to light, and his work with the Chinese passengers is doing exactly that hard work. Schwenkert is the co-creator of the multi-award-winning documentary about the Chinese passengers, The Six, which was exec produced by James Cameron. We talk about James Cameron a little bit in the live show. Schwenkert is also the creator and host of the Titanic New Jersey podcast. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple or Spotify. There are a couple of episodes up already, and they're fantastic. They're wonderfully done. Make sure you're subscribed so you get the notification when there are more. And he is the executive producer of the new rail disaster documentary, Wreck of the Broker. Make sure to follow him on Instagram. And I will link the, in the show notes, I will of course link all the info about The Six. It is streaming in countries that are not the US. So I think I say this in the live show at one point, but if you have a VPN, then you may be able to stream it. I believe it's streaming in Australia and Canada, maybe Japan too. But yeah, it's, you know, it's hard to sum up a person this accomplished their work in just a few sentences, but I hope that does some justice to Stephen's long resume. I sound like I'm gushing at this point, but I'm just so grateful that he was willing to come down and spend a weekend in Tennessee. We had a blast. We had, as you'll hear in the live show, we had a fantastic time talking about some really important research around the Chinese survivors. We touch on just the idea of research. We talk about some of his experiences making The Six, interacting with the children of survivors. There's so much depth here. We got some great questions from the audience. And we also just had a blast at the Titanic Museum. I cannot thank them enough. Thank you, Mary. Thank you, Emily. Thank you, Katie. Thank you, Crystal. Thank you, everyone there, for welcoming us with open arms, literally rolling out the red carpet for the live show guests. Literal red carpet was laid out. My kids were, they were beside themselves. I think I'm saying that right. When they got the lanyards and it had my name on it and had Stephen's name on it, it had Unsinkable on it, and it said VIP and there was a red carpet, they 100% thought they were walking a Hollywood red carpet, and it made their entire year. So thank you so much. I'm tearing up thinking about it. The museum creates this beautiful experience to learn about passengers. It was wonderful. I'm so glad that you're going to get to listen to this show. Fun side note, never, ever, ever ask Stephen Schwenkert about my diet or what I eat on a daily basis, because he'll give you the wrong impression. Let me tell you, I fed him nothing but junk food, and he was very understanding. It was laughable at one point. We started our weekend with Waffle House, which, I mean, that's just a given when you haven't been in the South in a while. So he needed some Waffle House. But then from there, I should have given him some fruit and some veggies. Instead, we had the custard at the new Titanic Museum custard shop. Then we had popcorn for dinner one night at the Unsinkable movie premiere. And it just got worse from there. I think the healthiest meal that I presented to him was at a brewery, and it included tater tots. So, you know, anyway, I'm sure the next time that I see Stephen, I will make sure to be carrying a salad to prove a point. But thanks again, Stephen. It was a blast. Thank you to the museum, of course, for everything. A couple of notes about the recording. The sound at the beginning of this recording is not great because I was standing with a separate mic and wasn't in front of our recording podcast mic. So the first 3 or 4 minutes, you're going to think, oh, I'm not listening to this if the sound is like this the whole time. It's not. About 3 or 4 minutes in, I sit at the table with Steven. We get in front of the podcast mic and all is well, and the sound is actually really good. And also there's a couple of weird transitions at the very end. I wanted to include some content at the very end that was fun to include, but I edited out the like 10 minutes where we were doing a raffle for books and things like that. It would have been very boring to listen to on a podcast, us just call out numbers and that sort of thing. So the editing is a little choppy at the end, but no big deal. A couple of other things before I get you to the episode. I've got some, very importantly, Patreon shout outs. I'm woefully behind on Patreon shout outs. So here we go. I want to extend a huge thank you to the following new VIP Unsinkable members. As always, if I mispronounce your name, please shoot me an email and let me know and I will fix it and I will redo it because I take that very seriously. Thank you to Zen Amaterasu. Thank you to Abby. Abby joined at the Think Tank level. So Abby, you get to pick a bonus episode. Amazing. So please email me about that. Thank you to Crystal Leanne. Thank you to Caroline Christman. Thank you to Heather Marezak. Thank you to Reese Vacareza. And is that everybody? I think that's everybody for this group. Guys, it means the world. Patreon fuels the podcast. It allows me to pay my hosting services so that the episodes stay up in perpetuity. It allows me to keep all of my software up to date, all of my equipment up to date. And not only does it cover the cost, but as it grows a little bit, it does allow me a little bit more time to spend writing and creating and frees up some of my time during the week so that I can put more attention to research and that sort of thing. And many of you know I'm working on a book right now that is about my experiences traveling for Titanic and making this podcast and researching. And I'm so excited to get hopefully the bulk of that finished up this summer so that I can get it out into the world. And Patreon helps me do that. So if you have considered joining Patreon, now's a really good time to. There are 3 years of bonus episodes, and they're a decent size. Most bonus episodes are 30, 40 minutes, some are an hour, and they're fully researched episodes. They're a little bit more casual in tone sometimes, but if you've listened to everything in the feed and you want more content, it is there. And there's lots of tiers to join at. Bonus episodes continue through the summer. So even when the podcast goes on hiatus, as it does, you know, from late May to early September, bonus episodes and activity on Patreon continues. And joining Patreon for the summer is, if you want to support my work and my writing as I write this summer, that's a great way to do it. So I do appreciate that. A couple of more things. There will be some more researched episodes coming your way before the end of the season. There will be one more Titanic on film, which is going to be Unsinkable Molly Brown. There will be, finally, I will have the episode ready about the Syrian family that I'm spotlighting for an episode about the Syrian passengers. And there will probably be a sort of season wrap-up episode. So there's definitely more coming down the pipeline for May. Bear with me. And yeah, you know, if you're looking for more, definitely check out Patreon. There is so much there, guys. Those bonus episodes are stacked up. So, and we're also doing another book club meetup at the end of May. We're going to read Julie Cook's Titanic and the City of Widows that it left behind. So anyway, 15 minutes in, I'm going to finally get you to the live show. If you haven't already skipped to it, again, bear with me with the sound at the very beginning. I hope you enjoy it. It was such a delight to be at the museum, technically like just below where the bow of the ship is in the museum, because of course the museum is shaped like Titanic, like a replica, to be sitting there, to get to talk about the Chinese passengers' untold stories, the research process, just warms my historian's heart. And it was such a magical weekend. Thank you to everyone that came out. Thank you to Patreon members that came out. I got to meet some of you. I cried. I mean, I went back to the hotel after it was over and everything was done that Saturday and just was like washing my face and crying because getting to meet you guys, hearing your stories and getting to interact and do this live is just a dream come true. So thank you to everyone. I hope you enjoy listening to this recording if you weren't able to be there. And I hope you're having a wonderful week wherever you are. Thank you for listening to Unsinkable. I am LA Beatles, and it has been 112 years since Titanic sank, and we are all here telling her stories and listening to them, and that matters. All right. Talk soon, you guys. Enjoy this live show from Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. Searched on podcast apps for a Titanic podcast. I am newly, or my obsession had been newly renewed during the pandemic. I've been a Titaniac for a long, long time. And I couldn't find any that I felt gave me real research, long talks as you want from a podcast with experts and that sort of thing. I really wanted to get into the nitty gritty of new research that had been done. And I ordered books. And I sat at my desk for many hours, and one day I went to him and I said, I'm just going to do it. I'm going to make a podcast. Maybe I'll do 10 episodes. We'll see who listens. If 10 people listen, it's fun, it's wonderful, and I'll have just done a fun thing during the pandemic. But that turned into Unsinkable, and we have been all over the world with it. This is the second live show I've done. Last year I did one at Mackinac Island, the Grand Hotel there. And it's turned into a way for me to communicate with Titanic people all over the world. I've met amazing people through my work and travel. And today we have with us Stephen Schwenkert, who is one of those wonderful people that I've met in this process. When I was on episode 3 of the podcast, I contacted him, I think on Twitter, but it was still Twitter at the time, and I had seen the news about the six, the documentary about the Chinese passengers arriving. There's some screenings going on, some festivals, and I noticed it was exec produced by James Cameron that got my attention. I contacted Stephen, and he took a chance on nothing. I was nothing at the time, podcast-wise. I had 2 episodes. I said, will you take a chance on me? Come on the podcast. Let's promo the movie a little bit, do some collaborations. And he did, and he took the time. And ever since has been just one of the most avid and wonderful supporters of the podcast. And I can't thank him enough. So thank you, Stephen, for being here. And we will... Oh, wrong clicker. We will sit here a little bit about Stephen and get going. So... the film The Six, which is unfortunately not available to stream in the United States right now, but hopefully will be at some point again soon. It's a really powerful film about the Chinese passengers on Titanic, and Stephen is one of the co-creators and the head researcher in it. Before we start talking about the passengers, though, I really wanted to hear a little bit from you, Stephen, about how you arrived at your passion for the ocean. You're an explorer, you're a diver, you're a Titaniac, but you also research a lot of other things. Can you tell us a little bit about your personal journey?
Sure. Everybody hear me? Yeah. So first of all, LA, thanks for having me, and thanks to the Titanic Museum Attraction. This is my second time here. It's really a wonderful experience, and it, you know, every time it just sort of hits me a little bit differently. And today when I came in, they gave me the boarding pass for one of the Chinese passengers, Fong Long, which is, I have to say, was really moving. It's quite amazing when you bring someone's story to life that was somewhat dormant and just kind of sitting there in a dusty corner of the overall story. And I sent this to, I took a photo of it and I sent it to Tom's, or to Fong Long's son, Tom Fong, who lives in Wisconsin. And he was equally moved. So it's, you know, it's really amazing to see these things kind of come to life right before your eyes. So for me, I grew up in New Jersey, not too far from the ocean. Always loved the ocean. Hated getting my hair wet. Okay, the ocean was great right up to here, and then as soon as my hair got wet, I totally disinterested. Until my grandparents bought me a mask, and as soon as I could see underwater, I didn't care what happened to my hair. So from that point on, you know, I've always had a love of the ocean, a love of the things that live in it, and on and around it. And then, you know, later on, started learning more about the history and specifically the tragic history, that many times is maritime history. So, you know, Titanic was just kind of, it was just something that was there, you know, it was just part of the history of the Atlantic Ocean. Growing up near New York, it was something that you'd encounter from time to time. I remember very specifically when Titanic was found in 1985, after having said not too long before that, gee, I think they'll never find that. So, and then I got to meet Emery Christoph, who had done a lot of the ROV work with Bob Ballard early on. But it was something that was sort of there on the shelf. You know, Titanic was there on the shelf. I was interested in other things. I was learning Chinese. I was kind of headed in that direction. So it wasn't, you know, sort of a pure interest in Titanic. I read A Night to Remember for the first time when I was teaching English in China. It happened to be in the library of the university that I was teaching at, and it was, you know, it was wonderful to read that. And so it's just sort of another piece that got stored maybe in the back of my brain. And then my longtime friend and creative partner Arthur Jones and I, we did a documentary in 2013 about a Royal Navy submarine that sank off the Chinese coast. We really enjoyed it. I wrote a book. He made a documentary. And then we said, okay, well, let's make another one. That was fun. You know, let's make another one. And so we were working on a Shanghai shipwreck story. He was based in Shanghai, I was based in Beijing, and I said, all right, let's keep it local this time. And then in the process of doing that, I was Googling around, and he said, well, how are we going to tell the story? So much background, Chinese Civil War, people aren't going to know this story. How are we going to do this? And I said, no problem. It's a big maritime disaster. We're going to compare it to Titanic. So off the shelf came, you know, A Night to Remember and all the classics, and started reading them again and going on to Encyclopedia Titanica. And, you know, I know that I had seen something about the Chinese passengers on Titanic before. It was not a brand new subject, but there just wasn't that much there. You know, now there's more there on that page because we did a little bit of work on it. But, you know, I looked at it and I thought, you know, gee, that's interesting. And how come we know the stories of all these Irish passengers and Norwegian passengers and, you know, all these different groups, but we don't know what happened to the Chinese passengers? That's kind of strange. And so, of course, a late night Googling session ensued, and I didn't find anything, and, you know, did some searching in Chinese and didn't turn up too much more, and thought, but why don't we know about these people? It's not possible that all these stories just disappeared. It's not possible that they just disappeared. So where is that information? You know, who is the granddaughter in Illinois who's going to put up her hand and say, you know, my grandfather was on Titanic, or in Liverpool, or in Toronto, or, you know, wherever the person might be? And then when the anniversary came around, I had been thinking about this even before, you know, we finished Poseidon. Even during the 100th anniversary, I thought for sure some enterprising reporter in Hong Kong would turn up this lost story of the Chinese passengers. No, nothing. Silence. Crickets. And I thought, well, that's not possible. We've got to go find them. And so we were already 7 months down the track on our new project. And so I said to Arthur, I said, hey, let's do, you know, I think we're working on the wrong story. Let's work on this other story. And he said, well, what do you want to work on? I said, Chinese passengers on Titanic. He's like, oh, great. Could you pick something more obvious and mainstream? You know, and he said, there's nothing about it. And I said, let's give it 90 days. We'll do 90 days of work on it. And if we prove to ourselves that there's no story, then we'll just keep going on the course that we're on. We'll stick with the story we have. And 90 days later, we had completely changed course, and we were working on the Titanic stuff, and it was keeping both of us up at night. And I think we bit off a little more than we could chew at the beginning. You know, it's when Titanic is in the name of your project, you should know it's going to be big. Okay, don't underestimate the size, which was a key mistake that we made early on. So that's how we got started. That's how we got started on that road.
And so tell us who are the six. You know, I think some people here probably have a sense because they've listened to previous podcast episodes. You've been on the podcast. But who were you trying to uncover? If you could walk us through I keep doing it. I'm so used to my computer doing the slides. If you could walk us through who they were, how many Chinese passengers were on board total, and as you started your research, which I just have to say, it's one of the main reasons that I wanted Stephen to be the guest for this show and why I think his work is so important and the work of the film is so important, is that the Titanic story, there's still a lot to be told. There's still a lot of research to do, this myth that the research has been done and we're just pulling from the same threads over and over again. That's not true. There are passengers that we still don't know very much about. And prior to your work and your team's work, we didn't know enough about these Chinese men. So yeah, tell us who they were, why they were on the ship, and kind of walk us through how you decided to get at their lives and figure out what happened to them.
Sure. So even though the name of the project is The Six, there were eight Chinese passengers on Titanic, and six of them survived. So really, the six are the survivors. There were two that went down with Titanic, but they were, you know, there are a lot of misconceptions about them. There were a lot of reports that they were stowaways. They were not. They were fare-paying passengers, fare-paying third-class passengers. We have their ticket. That's well documented. They were not members of the crew. They were professional seamen. They were professional mariners. They were guys that worked in engine rooms. They occasionally worked as cooks on cargo ships or passenger ships. So there sometimes is a misconception that they were working on Titanic, that they were part of Titanic's crew. That's not correct. They were, to use the parlance of today, they were being seconded. In other words, they worked for a UK shipping line, and they were being sent over to work on that company's U.S. operations, because if you remember from your Titanic history, there was a coal strike going on in the UK. They were sitting around kind of doing not a whole lot. They wanted to, you know, be working. Their employer wanted them to be working, and so they were on their way over to the U.S. Now, it was a little bit of a strange situation because at the time, the Chinese Exclusion Act was in effect, so that even though they could work on ships going up and down the coast, they were really restricted from going ashore and you know, kind of making their way inland. So it was a little bit of a strange. Now it's a lot more common, kind of post 9/11 at U.S. ports. You know, you have all kinds of infrastructure within sort of secure port areas, so you can go to a shop and buy stuff. You can go to a restaurant. You can use a laundromat. You know, whatever, those things are there, and you don't need a U.S. visa in order to make use of that or to land at a U.S. port. At the time, you know, our infrastructure was not quite so sophisticated, so. You know, it was a little bit of a strange situation for them, but that's where the work was. That's where they were going there for. They were intending to meet their employer's ship, the Aneta, which was just a fruit boat. You know, it was what we call a fruit boat. They handled all kinds of cargo going up and down the east coast of the United States and then down into the Caribbean, Jamaica, Cuba at the time. And so that's what they were doing. So it must have been kind of strange, A, to be traveling on a ship but not working. It must have been a little bit of a strange feeling for them. And plus, you know, at the time they're getting on the, you know, largest moving object in the world. They had never been on a ship that had looked or been that large before. So it must have been a little bit disorienting for them. And, you know, they were among the most obviously foreign of all the passengers. Probably they wore Western dress, so it wasn't like, you know, they were dressed like in, you know, Chinese court outfits, but you know, they still would have been obviously different from a lot of the other passengers and certainly the crew. So they must have kind of felt that upon them while they were there. So you know, that's who they were. There were at the time, just a tiny little bit more background. At the time, there was a lot of labor migration out of China, because there had been some famines and some, you know, let's call them violent skirmishes. I won't call them rebellions, but violent skirmishes down in the south, sort of running out of land. And so young Chinese men were forced to find work elsewhere. And there was a big need. The with all due respect to those about to be mentioned, British sea captains started to report that they were less expensive and less drunk than the Irishmen. So that's why Chinese sailors started to replace what had previously been Irish sailors on British cargo ships. And it really started from there, and then they sort of spread out from there. So that's what they were doing aboard Titanic. You read some really vicious reports from the time saying that they're, and not just vicious, but utterly ridiculous reports from the time saying that they had stowed away in the lifeboats before they left Southampton. That's why they were able to get in the lifeboat when...
Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
I need to go closer.
Yep.
Prior to starting the podcast and being as deep in all of the research as I am now, you know, I took a big break from Titanic for grad school and such, and my interest kind of ebbed and flowed. But when I started reading again a few years back, I mean, this is a common misconception. And even some of the academic texts that you will come across will report this, that they were stowaways in the boats. And it's usually mentioned as a very flippant comment.
Yeah.
It's quite disturbing. Yeah.
And it's not, you know, it's not exclusive to the Chinese passengers. I mean, you know, probably a lot of us know the story that Harold Lowe had to apologize for his references to Italian immigrants, that the Italian consul in New York actually made him apologize after his testimony to the inquiry in New York. So it was just sort of a general, you know, distaste for, you know, people that didn't look like us, whatever that meant. And, you know, unfortunately, it's, you know, one thing you learn when you're doing Titanic research is, you know, you really got to put your white cotton gloves on and get your tweezers out, and you really have to go in and kind of pull out statement by statement, because so much of what we consider the canon of Titanic literature is, you know, some of it is repeated, some of it is hearsay, some of it is, and you know, most of it is well-intentioned. It's not that people are trying to intentionally deceive, but it's just, you're sitting around on Carpathia for 3 days, you've just had this horrible experience, you're exchanging stories like you would, you know, in just about any other situation like that. And then when you go to write your story down, maybe it's not so important that you didn't witness that particular event, or, you know, you just remember it differently, or someone, you know, seems to have clarified what you thought you saw happen or heard or whatever. So, you know, it's we're moving into a phase of Titanic research now that is much more forensic than it is historical, let's say. In other words, probably the first 50 years or the first 60, 70 years that we looked at Titanic, certainly before the wreck site was discovered, we really had no physical evidence. Everything was based on analysis of testimony, analysis of letters, analysis of interviews with people. You know, that's really what A Night to Remember is as a book. That's, you know, it's a collection of those accounts. But of course, we know that eyewitness testimony is not always reliable. People forget things, they remember things differently. You know, now we're kind of course, we're in a new phase where we don't have the firsthand accounts anymore. All the survivors are gone, and in many cases, a lot of their children are gone. So now we're almost down to third-hand accounts, but we can do ultra-high-res scans of the wreck, for example. We can do Google searches that give us a chance to compare things very quickly that people had never been able to do before. That you know, previously that process would have taken weeks or maybe even months to kind of put all those pieces together in the same place at the same time. We're able to build a model of a Titanic lifeboat and put people in it and say, well, were they hiding or weren't they? You know, what could Ismay have seen from where he was sitting in a lifeboat that would have made him think that these people were hiding underneath seats, which isn't physically possible? You know, things like that. So we kind of have... in some ways we have no choice but to look at things in a different way now, but it also gives us an opportunity to see things. It's like our satellite technology has gotten better before, you know, than it used to. You know, now we can see things much more clearly. We can see them from much farther away. Our telescopes are better, and that kind of applies to Titanic research in the same way.
No, that's beautifully put, and I feel like I spend a lot of my time trying to say what you just said, and you said it better than I ever could, which is why you're here. So walk us through. So you start the research process. You've got a list of names. You've also got, and I'll put the slide up. Interesting, and the six is actually produced by James Cameron, and so obviously he knew about the story of the Chinese survivors because there is a deleted scene in the film. Can you kind of walk us through that beginning process? You're starting the research. You've got things like this kind of circulating, so you know people are aware of them, and you've got a list of names, but kind of tell us why that list of names was complicated and complex in itself. It wasn't just, you know, eight names, because there were eight passengers, right. Only six of them survived, which is why the film is called The Six. But why was a list of names maybe not even as helpful as you wanted it to be?
So when we started off, I mean, I had to admit almost publicly that I had not watched all the deleted scenes on my deluxe two DVD set of Titanic that had been sitting at home, because then I would have seen this a whole lot earlier. But if you have watched them, or if you watch them online or whatever, there was a deleted scene of a Chinese passenger being rescued. Now, if you're really sharp-eyed throughout the film, throughout the Cameron film, you know, not only do you see Chinese passengers, but you see Middle Eastern passengers. You know, Cameron did a fairly good job of diversifying the background actors. You know, in the various scenes, and you do see this representative of the Chinese passengers pop up from time to time when Leo and Ralph Macchio are, you know, they just get on, they're running to their cabin. You'll see him in the background. So,
Fabrizio,
thank you.
Justice for Fabrizio. He gets a really bad.
Indeed, you know, we all have our corner of the story. So. So, you know, I put in the Magic Explorer terms into YouTube, which I think were China and Titanic, and this popped up, and then I watched this, and this was, you know, early days. I mean, the first week or so of us really kind of thinking about this. This pops up, we watch this, and immediately we know, okay, Cameron knew this story, he filmed it, so what did James Cameron know, and when did he know it, about the Chinese passengers? You know, where is Cameron's research file on them? And then also, gee, he's floating on a wooden piece of wreckage. That kind of looks like a door.
I think that's why it was
deleted. That Jack and Rose later find themselves on. Mm-hmm. Did the real-life rescue of a Chinese passenger inspire one of the great moments in recent cinematic history?
Yes, it did.
We must contact this Mr. Cameron and see what he has to say. So, you know, our research, obviously, you know, when you start anything like this, you're going to start off with the names. So we have this list of names, and the names are all two names. Okay, so it's like, you know, Jim Smith or whatever. But for Chinese names, certainly at the time, certainly a century ago, let's call it a two-phrase name, you know, a given name and a surname, that was very uncommon. Usually the family surname would come first, then there would be a generational name, and then there would be a given name. So for us to see these sort of two name, you know, these two names applied to all of them, we're thinking, okay, that's not really normal. So where are these names coming from? Are they coming from some kind of passport or travel document? Did their employer give these names to the White Star Line and say, okay, here are our passengers? Are these guys walking up to the counter saying, uh-huh, and then somebody's writing that down based on what they hear? You know, what are these names? And we're also trying to figure out what language group is this? You know, are these Cantonese speakers? Are these, you know, they're probably not Mandarin speakers. Not a lot of Mandarin speakers were going abroad at that time. You know, could it be... You know, we're just kind of trying to figure out, where are these guys from? Where are we going to look for records? Where are we going to have the greatest success? So we banged our head against the wall for about 2.5 years on the names. Should we accept the names as they are and work off them? Should we just forget the names entirely and try to find these people some other way? You know, in the meantime, we're trying, you know, we're using sort of existing tools, Encyclopedia Titanica message boards, other Titanic message boards.
Which is the Wild West, by the way.
that's an understatement. Sorry, Titanica board users, and just, you know, just trying to, it's a lot easier to find somebody when they're trying to find you. So if you go on and you're looking for people who are looking for information, maybe there's a descendant on there who's saying, I'm trying to find information about my grandfather, or, you know, whatever. So that's what we did, and we were extraordinarily lucky that we found this guy named Tom Fong, who was living in Wisconsin, still lives in Wisconsin, who had been trying to find information about what he said was his father. He said, my father was on Titanic, and I'm trying to learn more about the story. And of course, you know, because everyone on those boards is just so well-mannered, they essentially shouted him down and said, it couldn't be your father, it must be your grandfather. You know, I mean, that's the level of politeness on board. So, but it did give us a chance to find Tom and to talk to him and to hear his story. I will be honest, and I've said this to Tom's face, so I'm not, you know, talking out of school, but I found his story a little bit hard to believe in the beginning, because I too was surprised that he was saying it was his father. You know, his father would have had to be much older.
Just to clarify, so he would have, because how old is Tom now?
Tom is in his 60s.
So at the time in his 50s, maybe when this was going on, and so it did seem a little unbelievable, but his father would have had to father him in his
60s.
Oh, 60s.
In his 60s, So it just seemed like, you know, what you're hoping for at that point, especially with a story about which you're already skeptical, you want to find things that are a little bit more tangible, a little bit more believable. Okay, do you have any photos? Do you have, you know, a ticket from Titanic? Do you have, you know, any White Star, you know, stationery at home? You know, just things that are going to sort of, you know, bring it together for you. And then he's saying, oh, well, I don't know this name. You know, it looks like Fang Lang. You know, it would be more Fong. But anyway, their family last name was Fong, but they spelled it differently. He said, I never heard my father referred to this way, you know, as Fong Long or Fang Lang during his life. You know, he was always known as Fong Wing Sun. And so now we're trying to put these two people together. His father had told a cousin of his. He never said to Tom or his brother, I was on Titanic. Okay, they knew he had been in a shipwreck, in a big shipwreck, but they thought that was in China somewhere. But the first night that his cousin Henry arrived from Hong Kong, when they migrated over from Hong Kong, at a dinner in Chicago, he said to Henry, I was on this huge ship that crashed into an ice mountain and sank. Okay, ice mountain is also the Chinese term for iceberg. Okay, so, you know, I was in a... And one day, they were at a museum in Wisconsin called Dome the Rock, Home on the Rock, House on the Rock, something on the Rock. And there's a Titanic display there, because it's just basically a display of a bunch of stuff the owner had. And he happened to like Titanic. He had a couple of Titanic models. And Henry points to the Titanic model and says to Tom, you know, your father was on that ship. Tom had never heard anything about it. His father's gone at this point. And he said his father always wrote in a diary, and then at some point the diary was thrown out. You know, when they cleaned out his hospice, they've never found it. So to Tom, this was all news, so then he starts to try to find it, and then we found him. The great thing about Tom is that he is utterly without guile. He clearly had no, he didn't look at us as like, hey, maybe I can become famous, maybe I can become rich, maybe I can, you know, whatever. All he wanted was, he wanted to know his father's story. What didn't my father tell me when I had a chance to know him? And in that sense, it made him just utterly wonderful to work with. And, you know, we just got lucky. You know, if you look now at passenger lists and who was in what lifeboat, if you're here for the afternoon thing, you can ask those guys where those lists came from. But, you know, how did this name, Fong Long, become associated with the guy rescued from the water? We have no idea. Because there's nobody, you know, there's nobody on Carpathia with a clipboard saying, I'm sorry, what lifeboat were you in? Okay, and your name? No, that was all reconstructed after the fact. We just happened to get lucky that the actual relative of that, you know, that that name was associated with that passenger. And, you know, that his son happened to know that story. And I don't, to be honest, I don't know what we would have done if that, that weren't the case. I don't know if we would have, had the same success.
And what's phenomenal too, I want to move on to, you know, kind of your research. We can see a few photos up here, and a lot of it is in the film as well. But before we get to that, I just want to point out something the film and your research does such a good job of sort of historicizing, for lack of a better term, a simple term, that it's very extraordinary that 6 of 8 Chinese passengers survived. There were a lot of non-white, non-Anglo passengers on Titanic, and up until, I don't know, the last decade, you wouldn't know it, really, based on any of the films or books or anything in pop culture about Titanic. Certainly, there was a huge group of Syrians on board. There was a Japanese man on board. There was a man who was the black man on the Titanic from Haiti on board. There were so many non-white passengers, so many people that didn't speak English, but we get the romanticized version, especially with the Irish passengers and such. But the non-white groups, the non-Anglo groups that are on Titanic, especially in third class, the survival rates are dismal, like just abysmal. So 6 out of 8 Chinese passengers, all in third class, surviving, this is a really big deal. And, you know, coming out of all of your research, and as you headed into the work of this, which is many years of your life, can you tell us a little bit about why you think that is? Why did 6 of 8, it's hugely significant.
Sure. I mean, I think it's two things. You know, and that really surprised us at the beginning, because if you look up, you know, sort of survival rates, if you drop that kind of stuff into an Excel sheet, you find out that, you know, I think there were 33 Austro-Hungarians and every single one of them died. You know, there are other groups where the survival rates are just awful.
Yeah, the Syrian survival rate is not good.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just so what's so special about these guys? Well, I think, first of all, you know, part of it is just simple geography, where they were quartered, so they're traveling as unmarried men, which means that they're in the bow. Okay, they're the third-class families or women with children were quartered towards the stern.
So they are where Jack and Fabrizio would have been.
That's right, exactly. you know, so they were on effigy deck. So they're probably quite close. We don't know if they were on the starboard side, but, you know, in terms of where they are in the ship, they're quite close to where it strikes the iceberg, all right? And plus, these are seasoned sailors, okay? They know when something's wrong on a ship. And they must have heard and felt the collision. You know, the other thing is they're getting flooded out very quickly. That scene towards the beginning where, you know, everybody's kind of got their stuff and they're going up Scotland Road and, you know, I mean, that's, you know, within 20 minutes they've got cold water under their feet. So they know something's wrong. They know the ship is sinking, even if a lot of other people don't. They have no choice. They've got to get out of there. So the other thing is, and we worked with... we worked with Tom Linsky, who part-time explorer. He's doing the sinking live stream tomorrow night.
Yeah, the Sea of Glass team here is live streaming from the museum, and he'll be one of their guests.
Right, and so, you know, he had done a virtual reality kind of recreation of the ship and the sinking and so forth. So we turned to him, and you know, Arthur despises when I use this phrase, which is why I'm going to use it again. But the map is not the territory. You can sit there with the blueprints until you are also blue in the face. But until you walk through something or see it for yourself, it just doesn't make sense. It does make sense the way it would have looked to them. So what we realized is when they came out of their cabin, the watertight doors had fallen. There's nowhere for them to go but up, okay? They have to go up the staircase. That's a good thing. That probably contributed to their survival. And that's true of anybody that would have been on those decks. There's nowhere to go. They're not going to get lost down some passage. They have to go up. Okay, so that probably takes them up to CD deck. They're going to hit Scotland Road. If anybody's, you know, if any stewards are there guiding people, yeah, head to the stern, head to the stern. The other thing is these guys are sailors. They know their way around a ship, okay? They know how to get through a passageway. They know. It's just like, you know, there are probably ways in and out of this room that don't involve that elevator. But you don't know any of them. You know, we don't know any of them. But the crew know. You know, they would know how to get out of here if they had to. And so we figure that they probably saw a few emergency doors, ladders, whatever. But we don't believe that they ended up on the boat deck until very late in the sinking. I'm not going to spend the 20 minutes to explain why. Ask me later if you. But
hopefully there'll be a chance to view the film soon, and that some of that is in there.
It shows up. We suspect that because of the boats, the where the survivors got off, they got off in boats that left very late. Okay, they're not getting off in the early boats. That means they're not on the boat deck. Okay, and also there are no passenger or crew recollections of seeing Chinese men standing around waiting to get into boats or fighting their way into boats. You know, there's no mention of them until very late in the sinking. So, you know, we think that they probably would have been up close, maybe back in the stern, in the third class parlor. But, you know, at some point they were able to find their way up. Otherwise, the other thing that really saved them is they make four of them, at least, make a counterintuitive decision very late in the sinking that saves their lives. And that is, you know, when Titanic, you know, choose whatever angle you like, when Titanic is sinking and it's getting closer and closer to the waterline, and you've got the collapsible boats up here on the bow, you know, people are seeking the high ground. You know, you've got a lot of people kind of heading towards the stern. They're still thinking that Titanic's not going to sink, that it's going to stay afloat, and so therefore they need to be up here. Our guys make a counterintuitive decision and head towards the waterline, which is where the only boats that remain are left. That's where the collapsible boats are being assembled, and that saves four of them. I attribute that to them having been, you know, having worked on ships and just, you know, understanding things like that.
And it's probably likely that when they got on board the ship, if this is their profession, they probably sort of scoped everything out, right? I would imagine that's in that situation, that's what you do if you're on ships like that. You know, now that we're talking about the lifeboat, so I have a few images up here that Stephen was kind enough to send to me of kind of the process, and these are stills from the film. Up in the right-hand corner, you are standing with a lifeboat that you commissioned. Can you talk to us a little bit about why you guys built a lifeboat and what research question you were getting at?
Sure. So very simply, I mean, you know, I had a little bit of trepidation when we started working on the Titanic project because, you know, there were voices in the back of my head of, you know, just we had a slightly negative experience early on when we were told pointedly by a Titanic expert that I won't name that we shouldn't sugarcoat the story because we lived in China and, you know, that the Chinese men had acted ignobly and we shouldn't attempt to show it any other way. And we were only a few months in at this point. We didn't really know anything about anything. And our intent was always to let the evidence speak for itself. If the evidence showed that the men had taken babies and thrown them in the water to get themselves in the lifeboat, we were going to talk about that. You know, it was just sort of the way it was going to be. And one advantage that we had in trying to tell the story was that we could apply physics where previously, you know, only analysis and speculation had been applied. So, you know, I thought from the beginning, the only way we are ever going to show that they weren't stowaways in a lifeboat was by building a lifeboat and putting real people into it. Okay, we had to do that. So that's me being the proud father of, at the time, the only existing collapsible lifeboat, you know, Titanic collapsible lifeboat model in the world. Sadly, it didn't survive COVID. We worked with a local international school and they decided to get rid of it, which absolutely broke my heart. You know, it was something that absolutely had to be done. And, you know, it taught us a lot. There were things that we learned on the day. there were things that we didn't know until we actually put people in the boat and went to different spots in the boat and looked in perspective. And, you know, the map is not the territory. We had to build the territory. In this case, we had to build the territory.
And it's research. I mean, this is what I'm talking about. The, you know, the Titanic story gets a little stale, a little dragonfly in amber often, and it's because we need new models and ways of research. It's not just sitting in an archive that's dusty and looking at names. That's important, and historians do a lot of it, and you've done a lot of that, and that stuff is crucial. But this is research. Like the process of building that boat and putting people in it and seeing what happened so that you can figure out what happened night of sinking, that is research, and that's modern and progressive research in a way that is, it just astounds me. It's brilliant. When I was watching the film, that is probably the part that stuck with me the most. But yeah, I think, you know, the average person doesn't think about a process like that as research, yeah. But it's really important.
So in this corner where I look strange up there, we went to a cold water research facility where essentially, you know, they test dry suits for Coast Guard crew and just, you know, survival in cold water. And so I was the volunteer that day, and I got to go into 40 degree water and see how long, you know, how well I would do and how long I would last. Of course, the water around Titanic was much colder that night, but what we needed to know was if Fong Long got himself onto a piece of wreckage, you know, and was able to save himself, how long did he have? Because that affects the timeline, okay? If you say, well, this person was in the water this long and you know, then they got out, you know, the cooling rate drops and, you know, then Harold Lowe's boat goes back to rescue people, that all affects the timeline, okay? You can say, well, I think it was 45 minutes. Physics is going to give you the answer because a person can only, it's not even that they can't survive longer, it's that they're not functional. Okay, at the end of this demonstration, when I'm freezing, I have to tie a knot onto a piece of wood, and it takes me 18 seconds just to go, you know, and it's just because your hands are too cold and you can't, you're sending the message and it's not being received. So if he was able to, you know, get away from Titanic, get onto a piece of wreckage, and hang on, how much time did he have? You know, and again, I was in water that was relatively warmer than what he was in. But again, you're only going to find that out when you go and do it. Sometimes you have to volunteer to be the test subject. So, you know, another forensic avenue that we looked at but wasn't really within our resources to do was down here in, that's Fairview Cemetery in Halifax. It's the main Titanic cemetery, and there is some evidence that there may be an Asian passenger buried in one of the graves based on the descriptions of bodies that were recovered. One body was described as like Japanese. Well, we can account for the one Japanese passenger. He was rescued. We had our 8 Chinese passengers. 6 of them were rescued. There were no other Asian passengers on board. So if there's, you know, if it's an Asian body, then it's, you know, one of our guys. We just didn't really have the resources to kind of do the DNA core sampling that would be required to do that. And Fairview Cemetery is kind of tired of Titaniacs and Titanic researchers going in there and wanting to dig up graves to find
them. Well, there's the, you know, Jay Dawson grave and such, which...
There is indeed, yeah.
You may have heard reports that women take undergarments and things to the to the Jay Dawson grave. So I can imagine them feeling a little fed up with the obsession over that.
It's an active cemetery. It's a very large active cemetery. So it's, you know, I can kind of understand that, you know, when you see it, it actually occupies a very small part. Cunard Line still maintains it. They still pay to maintain it, but. But you know, you just have to go out and you have to go out and you have to sit with the documents. You have to recreate things to the best of your ability. You have to, you know, it's the only way you're going to, because, you know, the example I always give is the band. Okay. So we all love Titanic's band. We love Titanic's musicians. There's no enmity towards the band whatsoever. And yet we cannot agree upon, did they play right up until the moment that Titanic went under, or did they stop sometime before that? And what did they play? Was it August? Was it Nearer My God? Did they, if we can't agree on the band, then we're never really going to have full agreement on most of the other Titanic related issues. So, you know, but physics can give us some of those answers. And that's really where we felt that we could make a contribution to the history overall. We just want to set the record straight, whatever the record was. We did not necessarily believe that the men had acted nobly or ignobly. You know, sometimes maybe they just acted. You know, it's not everybody's a hero and not everybody's a villain. Sometimes they're just a person. Sometimes they're just a participant. So, you know, we just wanted to know what did the evidence tell us? That's what we wanted to know. And therefore, the burden was on us to find and produce as much evidence as possible, whatever the story that told.
And part of that process is shining light on Chinese American history, the Chinese American experience, the immigrant experience, which, you know, Titanic obviously was an immigrant ship, and so this is such a crucial part of studying Titanic as well. And I want to open up, you know, to see if any of the audience has questions, and I know we're running a little low on time, but I did want to quickly ask if you could describe, you had a really amazing experience where you got to reunite a descendant of Harold Lowe, who was the Titanic officer that took the only boat that went back out. Of course, it's in the 97 movie. We all have seen that rendition of it. You got to reunite one of his descendants with Tom, who would have been one of the people that his father would have been one of the people that Harold Lowe saved. So I'm so sorry, I secondhand tell your story to people at dinner parties sometimes because I think it's such a good story, and I probably don't do it justice. But in studying Titanic, those are kind of the moments I live to hear about because, again, I don't want it dusty on the shelf. It's a living history, and I think when you got those two people together, that's probably one of the most important moments in Titanic history that there is. So do you mind describing that a
sure.
little bit?
So very briefly, I mean, the Tom Fong had a desire to meet, you know, he saw Harold Lowe as the man who saved his father's life and therefore allowed him to exist. So we said, well, how would you feel if we took you over to the UK and introduced you to Harold Lowe's grandson? Harold Lowe's son is long gone. And, you know, he talked about it like we said, you know, how about we take you to the moon and you can, you know, walk through the Sea of Tranquility. And, you know, it was just the same kind of, see?
Yeah, it's noon. You're on a ship and it's noon.
It's just the same kind of reaction. See?
Yeah. Immersive experience. Yeah.
So,
Katie knows. She's counting us down.
So, you know, so we set it up and we went over there. And of course, you know, I got into this story for the Titanic. I lived in China for 25 years. I went over there because it was a great story. It's still a great story. You know, I migrated from being a journalist over to whatever I am now. You know, but you know, I was in it for Titanic. You know, I was in that story. There were other great shipwreck stories to tell, but if we were going to do Titanic, I was in it for Titanic. So, you know, finally we get a chance to meet. Like, I mean, okay, Tom is a Titanic relative. I don't mean to, you know, downplay it, but you know, suddenly you get to meet like somebody from the, you know, Titanic aristocracy. You know, a grandson of a fifth officer. You know, and I thought, you know, what's the house going to look like? Well, John Lowe lived in this absolutely spectacular corner of Wales. He lived basically as far north and west as you can get in Wales before it crosses back over to like the Liverpool area. So we go up there, there's this river sweeping by, there's this huge Norman castle off in the distance. It's like, oh my God, what am I doing here? And then you walk up to the house, and you know, it's kind of an unassuming house, except that it has this giant plaque on it that says the former home of Titanic Fifth Officer Harold Lowe, and you're like, yes. And the good thing is, you know, if you see the documentary, like I'm in the background of this whole thing, which is great because Tom is very emotional, and I'm in the background, just my eyes are this big because like, that's a portrait of Harold Lowe. that's Harold Lowe's grandson, you know, and so.
I think everybody in this room is probably a person that, given that opportunity, yeah, would be in the same
and,
room. Yeah.
You know, I'm pushing it down the whole time. It's like, okay, we're here for Tom, you know, it's fine. And so then, you know, we go in and, you know, he was just, you know, really nice. I mean, he was quite advanced in years, but, you know, very lucid, happy to tell the story. He had clearly told the story many, many times. And, you know, I noticed that there was a photo of Harold Lowe in a frame. I mean, it might have just been a chrome frame, but it looked like a silver frame. And, you know, some things. And I could see that he had taken some things out that he was going to show Tom. And I thought, oh, my God, he's got buttons from the jacket. And, you know, just that kind of stuff. And so I was totally along for the ride. You know, I was just, you know, and you know, Tom was just very, and he turns and he's showing Tom these different things. And he said, well, your father would have been in this boat because this is, you know, the lifeboat that, that my grandfather rowed back in and all this kind of stuff. And he picks up the photo of his grandfather and he gives it to Tom. And he said, this is for you. I want you to have this. And I thought Tom was going to fall down right on the spot, you know, and I'm watching all this, like, you know, with huge eyes off camera, and he's doing, you know, and the whole thing. And I'm saying to myself very quietly, cry, Tom, cry. Tears, Tom, tears. You know? And Tom isn't that kind of guy. So, you know, but you could see that it was just, you know, he's kind of overwhelmed in his own way. And he gave him the photo. And then also Titanic Valor, the Inger Scheele book, which is down in the bookshop. Very good. It's very good, actually. It's an account of the life of Harold Lowe. And it was a wonderful source of information for us about, you know, somebody that was a critical figure. And he signed a copy of that and gave it to Tom as well. And, you know, then he took us into this sort of study. And there's photos of, you know, Harold Lowe holding fish that he had caught and, you know, kind of different, you know, nautical poses and whatever. And he showed him the buttons. And, you know, it was really kind of an amazing moment. But it's I don't think Tom was able to describe how he felt meeting someone that essentially had allowed him to exist. You know, he just really was kind of overwhelmed. Sadly, John Lowe is not with us anymore. But to have given them that opportunity to meet each other. And he says in the film, he says, the circle's complete. We found each other. And then he looks and he's, you know, I'm off camera, but he looked at me. John Lowe looked at me and I'm just stunned. It's like, well, what do I say? I'm just a bystander here. You know, I'm just the tour guide, you know. But, you know, it's just, and, The sad / funny thing is, if you see the documentary, we're outside and there's this drone shot of us standing there. It kind of comes around and whatever. And we're having this huge conversation and I cannot remember a single word of what we said. I don't know what Tom said. I don't know what I said. I don't know what John said. And, you know, it's just one of those moments where it's like a little bit too exciting and you can't process it. But yeah, so that was, you know, sadly, there are a lot of people in the film who aren't with us anymore, some because of COVID, some just because of the passage of time. So, you know, I'm glad that we got to, I always think of it as, you know, we took one or two of those big, you know, jigsaw puzzle pieces that are the Titanic story and we got to put them into place. Or, you know, maybe we took them out of the wrong place and put them in the right place. And, you know, we got to capture a few people's stories along the way. And, you know, I hope that other people come and stand on our shoulders and yes. You know, do more on it. So.
And we have a little bit of a fun announcement related to your research as well before I open up to questions. So, you know, obviously we hope that the film will be viewable in the U.S. It is in other countries, so I've been telling people if you have a VPN, which is totally legal, you know, you might be able to catch it on a streamer in, you know, if you tell your TV you're in Australia, which I do regularly. So I wanted to have Stephen here today because it's not just about the movie. I mean, the product of a lot of their work, but the research continues, Stephen's work continues, and the legacy of what you guys uncovered continues as we continue to find out as much as we can about these passengers and as you said, we hope others continue in these veins of research and that those puzzle pieces continue to go in. And so you have a fun announcement related to the six in another form that people will be able to consume and buy soon. So tell us about that.
So I'm very pleased to announce that the Chinese version of the book, The Six, was published a few years ago. I'm very pleased to announce that the English language version will finally be published by the History Press UK about this time next year. It's different from the documentary because, you know, I have almost unlimited space to talk about minutiae and, you know, just tell more of the story. You know, in a documentary, every minute, you know, costs so much money to put on screen that you're kind of limited in the story that you can tell. And especially since I saddled us, you know, since I put the albatross of this name, The Six, around our neck and committed us to telling six full stories or attempting to, you know, that really limited us in a 100-minute documentary. But, you know, the book will be out about this time next year. I go into a lot of detail about, you know, the lifeboats and just some of the things that will be of particular interest to Titanic folks because, you know, they tell us. What always interested me most about the story of the Six is what it told us about the Titanic story at large. It tells us a lot about the third-class passengers. It tells us a lot about some of the other immigrant groups that were on Titanic. It, you know, it just really, you know, casts a light on Ismay and you know, Ismay as a person and his testimony. You know, really kind of, I always thought of, this is a really deep reference, but I always thought of it as Rosencrantz and Guildenstern on the Titanic. It's like, you know, to do a bit of an obscure Shakespeare, you know, they're not major characters, but they are people who pop up at very important moments in the story and tell us things about those moments. So, looking forward to bringing the book out next year. And, you know, I'm going to field one of the first questions, which is, how do we see this vaunted documentary? So we have not had success yet getting a U.S. distributor or a U.S. streamer. You know, we're still popping it up. The museum attraction was nice enough last year to feature it on streaming, and so that was wonderful. It gave people a chance to see it where they hadn't before. We've been in a bunch of festivals, so I'm not sure that's going to happen too much more. We're still fighting a bit of a guerrilla war, having screenings here and there when we can. So what I would say is stay tuned, and hopefully we'll be able to bring it to you very soon.
Are there any questions?
Yes.
You mentioned at the beginning how there's some books out there that's accurate and some that are not really. There's a book that came out in 2022 called Titanic Day by Day, and it lists victims. It's actually, you can go by each day of the year, and it talks about if the passenger died or survived, and I was just wondering if you think that was like an accurate book or not.
I have to say that I haven't read it, so I won't comment because I haven't seen it. But
I believe that's the one that's made by The Descendant, right?
It's
Robert Hitchens.
By Simon Medhurst.
Yeah.
Then I will say it is accurate because he consulted with us before. He in fact he actually held the manuscript for 10 days because I was too slow to get back to him. But yes, he asked us what any
some insider scoop
at guys. Least any information that he has. Was supplied by us, therefore it's as good as we have. That doesn't mean it's 100% bulletproof, but it's the best information we had, so yes.
And I think that, I have a copy of it. I haven't read it cover to cover, but I think it's a cool concept, you know, to sort of flip open and take it day by day and sort of, you know, look at it over your morning coffee. Yeah. It's more of a collection of kind of factoids. Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yes.
That's a fantastic question. I mean, we certainly expected that it would get picked up for distribution a little more quickly as a result, but we did not. So, but I mean, it was what it told us is that, you know, on the one hand, because we were delving back into a time period when Chinese specifically, but Asians more generally were being their their entrance into a lot of countries was being restricted, including the United States, including Canada later on, and the UK in a sort of subtle way. You know, it showed us that these problems were not new. You know, it wasn't like suddenly people got COVID and, oh, gee, I hate, you know, my neighbor. It wasn't like that at all. But it also gave us hope that over time these things could be resolved, and that, you know, sometimes it just takes a very sad and difficult generation to resolve some of these problems. Ultimately, you know, anti-Chinese immigration legislation was not enacted in Canada until 1923, and stayed a lot longer, you know, stayed in place a lot longer. So it wasn't like it was on the way to getting better, it was on the way to getting worse. But eventually, of course, it was resolved. So, it taught us a lot about that. I mean, it showed us that there were still a lot of open wounds that had not been, you know, addressed, and that people had just kind of, you know, moved on without resolving them. They knew all about them, and they, you know, a lot of people that we talked to, you know, they would come to us and say, oh yeah, my father was a paper son, which meant that, you know, he came in on a false identity. You know, people were very intimately, you know, knowledgeable of it and associated with it, but they just sort of said, you know, that was what we had to do, and we did it, and we moved on. And he said, you know, they knew that actually their legal surname was not their family's actual name, but just over time it kind of became their de facto surname, and then it ended up on all their driver's licenses. So now they're the Wongs instead of the, you know, the Johns or something. So.
Any more?
Yeah. Hi. I just want to say first, like, you're like one of my favorite podcasts.
Oh, thank you so much. I realized too, I was so like frazzled at the beginning, I forgot to say the word unsinkable. So. Welcome to Unsinkable. No, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I actually got to show the film by claiming I was in Canada for like a book club that we did on
There you go.
Cool.
Yeah.
So you talk about how we're entering into a like a forensic stage and learning more about Titanic. Do you think with that we're learning more about like third class pastures, such as like with the Sikhs and Syrians, whereas with when it was more like the historical stage, it had more of like more of a centerpiece towards like those who were first class and second class, kind of like we're romanticizing like their stories.
I mean, let's face it, I think we're probably all still in it for the romance, you know? And that was something I said to Arthur very early on is, you know, I do not want to de-romanticize the Titanic story, because then it ruins it for me along with just about everybody else. But I said, I think we can tell these stories without de-romanticizing it. I think when, you know, it just makes the tapestry all that much richer when you can fill it out, and, you know, it's not just, you know, Irish parties down below decks and, you know, whatever. When you individual stories, nobody would be interested in the story of a very large piece of steel that's now at the bottom of the ocean. That, you know, there are a bunch of rivet heads who will be into that. But it would never have had the broad appeal, and you could never build a nonfiction or a fiction story around it if that's
and
all there was.
And other shipwrecks.
And other shipwrecks
all over the world, some of which unfortunately have had a larger death toll.
Sure.
But it's Titanic that has become this juggernaut.
But I think, you know, by adding in the stories of everybody else that was on board, you know, it just makes the story that much richer. It doesn't take away from any, you know, anything that was happening below the waterline doesn't take away from what was happening up on, you know, the top decks or on the grand staircase or whatever. I just think it makes the story better.
It's the puzzle. I really like the analogy of the puzzle pieces. Every piece of the puzzle is important, but we need to try to get them all in there. Yeah. Maybe one more. Is there one more? Yeah. Monica?
Yes. Like speaking with James Cameron.
Good question.
So we pursued James Cameron for 2.5 years. I, you know, it was just one of those things, and there were a couple of moments of doubt where it's like, this isn't going to happen. And like, what does that mean if we don't get him? You know, how are we going to? So really, we were basically wrapped. You know, we had shot everything we were going to shot. We had gone everywhere we were going to go. And really, the only thing left was James Cameron. And I was kind of working my way through the exploration community, where I knew some people that knew him. I had actually met James Cameron in Beijing in 2011 because I was hired to corral the international press for a press conference that he was having. And I said, okay. And I lowballed the person who asked me to do the press conference. And I said, I'll do it for, I think I did it for $250. I said, I'll do it for whatever, but there's one condition. And they said, what's the condition? I said, I get to meet him. I said, there's no way I'm doing a James Cameron press conference and I'm not shaking his hand. I said, okay, I'll call you back. So 5 minutes later, okay, you're on. So I met him, but more importantly, I met all the people around him. I met Marie Wilhelm, who is really his chief producer. I met a bunch of his other staff, and I put all those cards away for a rainy day. And in about 2017, it started to rain. And or it started to rain for us. And so it still took us 2.5 years because he was, you know, if we were this deep in Titanic, he was ceiling deep in Avatar. And so we made him an offer, which we hoped he would not refuse, which was, we'll take any 15 minutes you got anywhere in the world. Okay. So pro tip, if you make anybody that offer, ask for 30 minutes. So in July 2019, late June 2019, we finally got the go ahead, you know, like, okay, let's make this happen. And said, okay, where is it happening? And I mean, it was almost like throwing a dart at a map of the world. And it was supposed to be in LA, July 4th weekend, and then there was an earthquake. And then he said, okay, I'm not. He said, so if you want to come down to Wellington, New Zealand, I'll be there. And we said, okay, let me tell you, you think New Zealand is far from here, all right? It's far from everywhere, all right? Even from Beijing, which is they're almost in the same time zone, it was 16 flying hours. I flew to Melbourne, and then I had to change, and it's another ways to Wellington. And Wellington is about the size of Pigeon Forge. It's not a very big place. For a national capital, it's not a very big place.
James Cameron must basically own the entire...
He and Peter Jackson own a fair bit of property nearby. So anyway, so we finally got him. We booked into the place that we were supposed to book into, and we set up and we hired a local crew that had worked with him before and whatever. And his advance guy shows up like 30 minutes ahead of time with flowers. Okay, let's put these flowers in the background. Okay, very nice. Looked around, looked at us like, are these weirdos? Like, can I let Jim talk to these people? And it was fine. And he kind of, and so 30 minutes later, in walks James Cameron, made up, ready to go. Need a coffee, need a water. Nope, I'm good.
Apparently he's tall.
He's tall, yeah. He's like 6'3", maybe 6'3.5". And so he sat down, he was ready to go. Bam, we did our interview, and then he hung out for about 10 minutes afterwards because he had questions for us, which I thought was awesome. He said, I'd really love to stay and talk more about this, and it sounds like a wonderful project. And by the way, what else can I do to help you? And that's how he got to be the executive producer. And when you see the documentary, all the footage that's in it from the Cameron film, he cleared it for us.
That's what I was about to say. It's a huge deal to be able to feature that.
Saved us. I mean, it saved us a fortune. We couldn't have done it otherwise. We would have had to animate it or whatever. And so I have nothing but pure gratitude for James Cameron. He, you know, it wasn't a gimmick. We didn't go after him because, oh, if we get James. No, it wasn't anything like that. It was, James Cameron is a legitimate Titanic expert. He is one of the leading underwater explorers that we have in the world today. And we needed his voice. We needed to hear what he had to say about this. And that's why we did it. And he was great. He was absolutely great. And we're really grateful.
Wonderful. Well, I wish we had more time. I do want to do a couple of fun things. First, and I'll say it 20 more times, but thank you, Stephen, for answering all these questions, for presenting this research to us. It's so important for the entire Titanic community and to have you here at the museum, and I feel lucky to be here at the museum, so thank you. I was 19, do you remember?
I think it was this gentleman.
There we go.
Of course.
Can I do a knowledge base for this one?
Yeah, we have, next we've got
can we do a trivia question?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, all right.
Okay, let's do it. This is Stephen's book.
Yeah, it's not from the book. It's not from the book.
And he's going to sign
it. So what's the nearest Titanic grave or memorial to Pigeon Forge? Where is it? I'm looking for a city. It's a major city. It narrows it down.
Yeah, I mean, just throw out a guess.
Yeah.
I mean, it couldn't hurt.
Atlanta.
We have a Nashville, Atlanta. Anybody else?
Who said Atlanta? Yeah, you win. Yeah.
Yay!
It's at the Capital City Club. It's for one of their first class members. I forget his last name, but I was looking that up. Because I wanted to see if there were any... if there were any Titanic graves or memorials near here, but not too close.
There's a, I was interested, we're new North Carolina residents.
R-O-B.
We live just outside Asheville. And when I moved to North Carolina, I did some searching trying to figure out the North Carolina connections, and there's really only one, and it's the postal clerk. And there's actually, I haven't been yet, but in his hometown, there is apparently a tiny little Titanic museum at the post office that is dedicated to him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And where's that at?
Foxborough, yeah. Foxborough. Thank you. I forgot that it's been a while since I've looked at that.
Thanks very much. Yeah.
I'm about to stop recording, but guys, thank you for being here for one of Unsinkable's live shows. I have been working with the museum for obviously a couple of years now and have a special relationship with them. So right here with Emily and Mary and Crystal that are in the room. Thank you so much. Oh, and Katie, and listeners of the podcast know Katie. She's been on three times,
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. and we've become great friends. It really is just such an honor and privilege to be here. Thank you, Mary. What you've created here is just incredible, and to be able to be here and be just a tiny, tiny part of it even is just so meaningful to me. So thank you, and thank you, Stephen. This is a wonderful presentation. I think everybody in this room is so lucky to have heard him speak. So thank you for coming to see Unsinkable. You guys are amazing. I appreciate it. And stick around if you're able to. I think most of you in here will know about it, but there is the round table with the authors of On a Sea of Glass at 3:00, and Stephen will be joining. So thank you.